What if everyone who wanted a job had a job, could get a job?
That would be an interesting question. I'm not sure that a citizens' assembly, that it would be the right format for that kind of question.
Okay.
I'm just not sure. So the question might be, that you might put to a citizens' assembly, would be more along the lines of, you'd have to have a body which has some defined influence. So, for example, the state government. And you have to work out what sort of, what the actual task is that the assembly is going to decide. Because if you just say, what if everyone who wanted a job could have a job? Everyone's going to say, yep, that's a great idea, fantastic. It doesn't give us any ideas about the mechanism of how we could actually operationalise that, how we could make it a reality. So what you might do is have, for example, a discussion about where should government invest money to ensure that, I'm trying to think of a word for good jobs, so the decently paid ongoing work is available to the widest number of people in the shortest possible time. Or we have $1 million to invest, I know that's nothing, but let's say $1 million to invest. Where would be the most best use of that money to create meaningful work?
I see.
So something along those lines, where it's a lot more clearly defined, might lead to better results.
So, basis of a citizens' assembly, can you give us a rundown on that?
Okay, so a citizens' assembly is basically a bit like a jury, but it's a randomly selected group of people who are chosen to get informed upon a particular topic, a particular task that they're given, and make deliberative participatory decisions. So there's a few different steps to the process. The first one is the process of the actual selection, the random selection. And so let's take it as being a sample that's called by the City of Adelaide, the City Council. You'd be able to get like the electoral roll or some other database of names and addresses, and send out invitations to, if you wanted a citizens assembly of say 100 people, you'd probably want to send out about 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 invitations to people to sign up. You get probably about 500 or 600 responding, and out of that you'd be able hopefully to a demographically representative sample of the population of Adelaide. So that would mean that around half of people that are sitting in the assembly would identify as female. There would be a wide range of ages from, let's say, 18. Most citizens' assemblies actually then go from about 16 upwards, the ones that I've had something to do with at any rate. And then along lines of ethnicity, along lines of socioeconomic indicators. So you'd have people who are, for example, have no qualifications, sitting alongside people who've got PhDs, all coming together to be part of the decision-making process. The second stage is the getting informed. And now this is obviously one where people are concerned about undue influence of policymakers. So in order for the process to have legitimacy, it's really important that it's headed by an organising committee or a chairperson who is seen by political parties in particular to be neutral on the topic. Probably the most famous citizens' assembly in the English-speaking world was the Irish Citizens' Assembly on Abortion, and that was headed by a former High Court judge who chose 5 experts, 2 constitutional lawyers, 2 obstetricians and gynecologists, and 1 medical lawyer, who were there to inform the assembly. So they put forward the various facts, but they were also there as a resource for the assembly to draw upon when they were assessing the other bits of information that they were given, which in that case included 30,000 public submissions that were made available to the members of the assembly. So those pieces of information were summarised and presented to the assembly members, but they were also available publicly online, obviously anonymised where people wanted it to be. The Assembly could call people to come and give testimony, either people who made public submissions or experts in the field. And they, as I said, they also had their resident experts to provide input as well. Generally, people seem to think that they were very well informed. And it's really, I find it really heartening to see the way in which people were empowered by that process of becoming informed. There was a guy who said that he was one of the best informed lay people in the world on that topic at that point in time. And he said it with genuine pride in his voice in this short video that's available online. So there's the process of information, and then there's the deliberative decision-making process, which is that you're asking people to come together to with a blank slate, so they're not looking at a report that's been written by somebody else, they're basically writing the report, and come up with proposals to be made. So this is done usually in small groups, trying to ensure that no particular person or loud voices dominate discussion. Often the days are organised so that people move around and no cliques are formed. People are asked to explain why they hold the point of view they hold, rather than that they are staunchly defending a position. So because you're taking the partisan politics out of things, people are there as individuals trying to come up with solutions to a problem in as much as a consensus way as possible. It's very different to, say, the parliamentary process, which even from the very sort of architectural design of Parliament, it sets up oppositional styles of debating and moving forward, whereas this is more setting up consensual styles of deliberating and moving forward. And it's been shown through research, doctoral research, that it can overcome even deep sectarian divides in societies that are as divided as Northern Ireland. So I feel that it's possible for there are very few issues in Australia where the divides are as deep as they are between Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland. So I think that it's a really powerful tool for overcoming the divides in community over issues such as climate change and, as you say, full employment and things like this. And then you come up with proposals which are usually voted upon by the Assembly. And the last stage, which has had a spotty history, at least in South Australia, is the influence that the proposals have. So in Ireland, the legislators had said that they would put the decision to a referendum, particularly if it was recommended by the Assembly that Article 8 of the Constitution, which bans abortion, basically, was recommended to be repealed, then that would be put to a referendum, and that it would be put into a referendum in the same way as was recommended by the Assembly, because obviously that you can repeal the article but not put anything else in place, which would be enabling provisions for access to abortion. And that's what they did, and the level of support in Ireland for the proposals was a little bit higher than it was within the Assembly, to the surprise of the legislators. In Gdansk in Poland, where they had a citizens' assembly, the mayor agreed that any proposals that got more than 80% of the vote within the citizens' assembly would be automatically accepted into the legislation. I mean, there wasn't a mechanism for that, but they did follow through on that. So that influence is really important to defund beforehand, because otherwise you can get a situation such as the one in South Australia, where they had two citizens' juries, which are pretty much the same thing as citizens' assemblies, on the issue of nuclear waste,
yes.
But then just basically completely ignored the outcome of it, and have been discussing where to site the nuclear waste up rather than going with the majority of the people in the assembly who really voted against having the nuclear waste dump at all.
Yes, which was completely wasted, wasn't it, if they weren't going to take any notice of it?
It was a waste of time, it was a waste of money, and it was also a way, it also undermines democracy. It deepens the disconnect between legislators and the people they supposedly represent. And for the people that participated, it's a really empowering thing to be part of the process, as long as you aren't ignored. When you've worked really hard to, because from all the citizens' assemblies that we've seen around the world, including, for example, the recent ones on climate in France and the UK, people work really hard. They invest a lot of time and energy in doing a good job in these things because they believe in the process and they given the impression that their opinions will have influence. For that to be just completely ignored in that way really does make a mockery of the idea that it's of democracy, and I think that's really disconcerting and really worrying.
Is there room in our democracy for such a thing as a citizen assembly?
Well, we've already been running... Australia has been running citizens' assemblies since 2009, both formal and informal ones. I lived in Melbourne, and there was a participatory budgeting process done by the City of Melbourne for a 10-year plan. There's been local city councils that have been run by citizens' assembly. There's been a lot of gender equality. In Perth, they've done it on issues such as parking. So there are already... There's been quite a number of citizens' assemblies across Australia, huge variety of issues. Most of them, unlike the one in South Australia, have had quite significant impact upon the view on the legislative agenda or on planning processes and things like that. So I think there is already room in an advisory capacity. I think what would be really interesting to see, and there are already moves afoot in certain local councils, would be standing citizens' assemblies to advise elected legislators. So here in Victoria, Kingston City Council has already started to put forward plans for a standing citizens' assembly to advise elected legislators.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Yes, I think so too.
And how did that come about? Was there someone who was really pushing for it?
So there was a lot of support within the council for it, and the mayor in particular was very supportive of the idea. And yeah, so there has been an ongoing process of it up that's been going for, I think, about 2 years now. There isn't much that's been written up about the process, so there's a limited amount of information available online. But I spoke to one of the people who was helping to design it with the council, which is how I know about it.
And the whole council is behind it.
I think that there has been a learning curve, but the council is generally behind it. But it was certainly the mayor was the most passionate advocate for the policy.
So here in Adelaide, we have something called Have Your Say, which I suppose is similar. I'm not at all sure how much our say is listened to.
Well, I think that's obviously that's one of the key problems with quite a number of the citizens' assemblies in Australia, and they're often referred to as citizens' juries. I don't know much about the Have Your Say process, but can I just ask, is it actually a randomly selected group of people, or is it self-selecting and you choose to make a submission?
Yeah, you choose.
So that's quite a different process, because what you find with, which is a more traditional method of consultation, and what you find with those more traditional methods of consultation is that, I have made countless submissions on a huge range of topics, but I bet that that's not true of the vast majority of Australians.
Yes.
And you get people like me who are passionate about particular things, who make submissions, the people that tend to be better educated, that tend to be predominantly women, surprisingly enough, tend to be on the richer side of things, or people who are outraged about particular things. It's not representative of the broader swathes of public opinion. So it's not actually in some ways, a fair sample. It's a fair sample of people who get outraged, and I readily admit I am easily outraged by things, and that's why I make so many submissions about things. But I do not think that my views are representative of the wider public. So the difference between the sort of Have Your Say and a citizens' assembly is that element of randomness. It means that everybody gets a chance to at least see themselves represented in the decision-making body. Whether you are a single mother or whether you are unemployed, whether you've gone to university and got PhD-level qualifications or you've never had a chance to go to get an education beyond sort of the legal certificates and things, you can see yourself represented there. So you won't find somebody who's exactly the same as you, but across the various things that you identify as, you probably see someone who you can say, yeah, you know, that's far closer to me than anybody that sits in an elected chamber. And the makeup as a whole would be far closer to the general population. I mean, if you look at an elected legislature or even a consultative body often, they tend to be, as I was saying, you tend to be richer, tend to be whiter, tend to be more male than the average population. I mean, certainly for elected legislatures. So the idea is to get that much broader swathe of experience and opinion and demographic in a randomly selected body.
I love that.
That enriches it.
Yeah, that's awesome, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's really easy. It's not really easy to do, but technology makes it really comparatively easy and free of bias to be able to do it. There's a free open source computer program that will do this if you've set up your databases properly. The skill is in setting up the databases rather than ensuring that it's free of bias, if that makes sense.
And so do you think starting with a council is the best way to go?
I think that that's one way of going. And certainly I've been in touch with my local council here in Darebin about holding citizens' assemblies. And in fact, the local council here has held a citizens' assembly a few years ago on a budgeting exercise. We've been talking about doing sort of coalitions of councils. In Victoria, there are these alliances for greenhouse action. And so we've been talking about trying to work through them because then that defrays the cost a bit, because they can be quite expensive to run kind of citizens' assembly. So if you can bring a number of councils together, then it makes it more cost effective. And it also gives the outcomes more influence across not just the local councils, but also with the state legislature and possibly even the federal legislature as well. So I think that local councils are great, but I think trying to bring local councils together it makes it more powerful if that's possible.
Mm. So, yeah, my mind's buzzing with the opportunity that that is there.
Excellent.
Yes.
And, I mean, these things aren't, it's not just like a pipe dream. As I was saying, we've got it here, but in Europe they've really taken off since the Irish one, which was, my mind's failing me. It was about 5 years ago now, I think.
Yeah.
Possibly not even as long ago as that. So they've really taken off since then. In the UK, they've had local council level ones on issues from climate to traffic to transport accessibility. There's a national one at the moment that's been sort of put on hold, and they're exploring online options related to climate, which will be making recommendations to Westminster about what can be, now that Westminster, the Houses of Parliament there, have declared a climate emergency, what does that actually mean? Scotland and Wales have both held a couple of them as a national level apiece. You've got France has been holding a citizens' assembly on the climate emergency, which has been really interesting. Some commentators have criticised the radical nature of the recommendations that have come out of that. But when reading through, there's been a couple of news articles about it, and the level of climate grief that the people who were part of the citizens' assembly experienced on finding out what the experts say is the result, I'm not surprised. They were ordinary people that ended up in this chamber, and they feel that, I say, they were, the first article that I read came out about a week or two after the first meeting. The clearest message coming through was that they were all stricken by this deep sense of grief and loss, and they hadn't been prepared for that. I think that it was that they felt that radical action was commensurate with the risk and the threat that's posed by climate inaction. So, you know, they're happening and making difficult decisions, but informed decisions about what needs to be done in ways which are not non-partisan and to some extent binding.
So could you have a citizens' assembly on something like water, like selling water?
Yes, certainly. I mean, one of the mock citizens assemblies, so in Melbourne there was a sustainable living festival earlier in the year before lockdown happened. It's in February. It seems like a lifetime ago at the moment.
It does, doesn't it?
And one of the ones that we held was on water management and looking at what needed to be done to secure water supplies for the future. And the recommendations that came out of this mock citizens assembly that I ran included things like, it wasn't just sort of watershed management, it was that we need to be looking at wetlands management, we need to be respecting traditional knowledge on managing water resources in this country. The one that surprised me most was that there was a commitment to treaty with Indigenous owners, and considering that we started from the perspective of looking at water supplies, that came up really strongly was quite surprising to me, but I was quite blown away by it.
Yeah, it's fabulous.
Yeah, I think it helped that there was somebody in the room who is a traditional owner and also a water scientist, and they helped to inform the process. And that was one of the things that came out of it.
And has that been written up?
It has, but we haven't made it public yet. We are in the process of getting it up on our website, which I'll give you the website address as we come to the end of this chat.
Okay, I would love to put that around for people because that's really interesting.
And I'm happy to send you the results that you can put up as well. We held 4 mock citizens' assemblies, and we've also held a few people's assemblies, and we've had some really interesting results from all of them.
So you actually come together, don't you, to do it?
Yes, I've held 1 mock citizens' assembly online now as a result of the lockdown. So it is possible to hold a mock citizens' assembly online. It's a little bit more nerve-wracking because there are long areas of silence and you can't sort of go around and see what people are doing and how the discussions are progressing, but it is possible. So, and I'm really keen on trying to spread these tools and to talk to people about the power behind them and why they are a solution to the divisive nature of the politics that we're experiencing, not just in Australia but internationally at the moment.
So does it cost money to run a mock?
No, I've been doing them voluntarily.
Okay. Will you do one for us if we can? You said 20 people?
Certainly. Yes, certainly. If we, somewhere between 10 and 20 people, we could do that. I need to have somebody with a Zoom account and things like that.
Yes.
Yeah, we could do that.
Okay, I will definitely put that to people because it'd be wonderful to do a mock one so that when it comes to, that we a real one later.
Excellent.
Yes.
I'd love to do that.
Yes. Oh, that's wonderful. Well, thank you so much for that. Do you want to give that website address now?
Sure. It's coalitionofeveryone.com. So my organisation is Coalition of Everyone. We're a non-profit organisation. We're currently, we were set up last year, and we're looking at particularly citizens' assemblies to help us through this moment of climate crisis in particular.
Yes, yeah, and it's a really good thing to be looking at right now as well.
Mm.
Yeah.
Although, of course, with the changes since the middle of last year that we're all experiencing, we're also really keen on looking at how we can run deliberative participatory events to talk about, in particular, jobs for a just transition, how we can leverage the stimulus packages which are coming through to ensure that they work towards a better future for everyone, particularly in the area of job creation.
Yes.
We're also looking at that, and it would be great if you were interested in... So there we're looking at trying to raise some funds so that we can actually continue with this work and things like that. But if you've got any partners that are interested in that and in talking about that and perhaps putting something together, we'd love to do that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think partnerships are the way to go.
Fantastic.
Yes. Thank you so much.